I have a graph here which has high expectations and then low. So what number would this be? It'd be? Okay, good. Alhamdulillah, I was understood. All right. Over here, satisfy emotional needs and then don't satisfy. So this is 10. This is going to be 0. Okay. Now, what happens when you have a style of parenting where you... Let's start with the bad news, okay? The really bad news. Let's say that you don't satisfy the emotional needs of your children and you have very low expectations of them as well. In terms of like they're communicating those expectations, enforcing those expectations. What's going to happen with the child? The child is going to turn out, the predominant characteristic will be they're careless, okay? Because what happens is that they don't really have like sort of any type of motivation to like really do anything, right? They're not really, their emotional needs are not satisfied either, okay? Now, here, in this category, we have this one where you do satisfy the emotional needs, but you don't have, you have low expectations of them, okay? Now, what I mean by easygoing here is not the easygoing, which is a praiseworthy thing. You know, somebody, let's say there's somebody who's like easygoing, like they're not like, they're easy to get along with. I don't mean that. What I mean by easygoing here is somebody who doesn't really have, again, they're like, they sort of go along with the flow. They're used to getting things their own way. They don't ever challenge themselves to go beyond anything. They're used to always having somebody that they can go to who will cover up for their mistakes. They're not willing to own up for what they really do because their parents don't have expectations of them. So even, for example, let's say that they do something in school which is not so good and then their parents are called in, the parents are going to be a shield for them. And these type of children usually are the ones who don't do too well in school, okay, because they just don't have any motivation to like do well. And there's no backup from home either. Now, this one right here, where you have high expectations and you don't have the emotional needs being satisfied, that one we can classify as the dictatorial parenting style, where basically you're a mini Fir'aun. You tell your kids, you bark the orders all the time, and you tell them, I need this and this and this from you, but you don't have that support for them, that emotional support that they need as children. Okay, that is not going to lead to a child who is successful, typically. What's going to happen is that they will have some issues. For example, they'll second-guess themselves all the time. Up where they have their emotional needs being satisfied by their parents. Okay, now, here, of course, the mother has a special role to play, but the father also plays a very important role. For example, especially for girls who are being raised, the father's role is very important for her to appreciate her, for him to appreciate her, for him to praise her, for him to play with her. It's extremely important. And as the son, of course, with the son as well, but as the son gets older, that that need that he has of the father even increases. Now, this type of child won't have the issues that the other ones have because on one hand, they've been given this sort of growth mindset that we expect you to be somebody who strives for excellence, right? We want you to achieve a lot, but on the other hand, we're there to support you as well. We're encouraging you. If you fail, we're not going to come and be like a dictator. We're going to be there to support you. We're going to like sort of encourage you. We're going to try to help you overcome your mistakes. We're on your side. We're not against you, but we also expect a lot of you as well. Okay, so. This is something that I found was very useful in terms of kind of analyzing different parenting styles. Now, we talked about the idea of setting limits and expectations. You know how when we talked about some of the areas where there's imbalance, sometimes people kind of err on this. They give too much freedom. They don't have limits and expectations. What are some areas where we need to give limits and expectations? I just want to mention a few of them. Number one is when it comes to salah. Salah is something where, there's really no compromise for that. From the age of 7, our children should be invited, encouraged to participate with us in prayers. And from between the age of 7 and 9, that process is taking place of them, getting used to praying and gradually getting to the point where it becomes part of their routine. Sometimes I see parents, like even the child has become baligh and they make exceptions for the child, for them. Right, they sort of say that, oh no, it's a late night tonight, so you don't have to wake up for prayers, or it's a long fast, so you don't have to fast. Right? Now, when a child is mukallaf, when a child has taklif, then it's not really our call for doing that. We can. There are some times where we need to give them advice as parents in making certain decisions which are difficult. For example, let's say it's a very long day, and it would be very hard for the child to fast. Sometimes they're not able to determine whether it would cause harm to them. Okay, so number one is salah. Number two is friends. It's very important that parents are involved in setting limits and expectations when it comes to the friends that their children have. This extends not only to friends in person, but also friends online. It's very important that parents are aware of who the children are talking to. Oftentimes, you know, children will say, that, okay, I'm just playing with my friends or my cousins. But then those cousins have cousins as well, too. You know, and sometimes these cousins are the opposite gender. And you know how it works when you get online, it's very easy for all the guards to kind of drop. Number three is media exposure. It's extremely important for parents to have limits and expectations. They should be filtering and monitoring and know exactly what their children are being exposed to. We're not advocating that we need to kind of live in the Stone Ages and not have access to useful means of, you know, useful uses of devices. I'm not saying that, but we do need to have limits. Number four is access to devices, where it shouldn't be the case that a child, whenever they want, they can go and use a device. Okay, it should be the case where it's regulated. It's something which permission is sought. It's, you know, parents are aware of what they're using it for. It's in the main room. It's not up in their bedroom. It's at certain times of the day. It's not when they're going to bed. And it's not using it for things which would be destructive to their upbringing. Number five is the amount of time spent on video games that needs to be regulated. Number six is junk food consumption. This is an area where I see sometimes parents, they don't have any control over this. And it affects them academically, like in a very noticeable way. Number seven is in having a bedtime. It's very important that children have bedtimes. This is the way that it was done in the past. It needs to be done right now if children want to be able to develop in a healthy sort of way. Number eight is having breakfast. I find that many parents, sometimes they don't have emphasis on this, but it's something which, you know, a lot of studies have shown that this is one of the means of being able to attain success, academic success, for example. And also, when it comes to priorities, it's very important that that parents, you know, are actively involved in ordering the priorities for their children. Things like, okay, when do you do homework? Right? Things like, okay, you know, this is Muharram right now. We need to put away these type of things, right? So these are some areas, again, where I find that sometimes my parents think that they don't have the right to tell their children, but no, actually, they do. They should be. It's very important. It is 7 o'clock right now. I'm going to, at this point, stop the formal part of the presentation. I hope, inshallah, that these tips were useful to you. I don't know your culture. I come from a different culture, but I think there's a lot of things that are in common, and hopefully, if not all of it was useful, at least some of the points were a good reminder for you. I will now take your questions. Bismillah. Yes, brother.
Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Just with regards to what you mentioned about tantrums, so say if you have your child in school or at madrasa and they see like all their other friends, they have like a mobile and then they're playing games during recess and they want that phone basically and they want a game. How do you sort of overcome this? Because then they'll start throwing tantrums and et cetera, et cetera. You get the point. How do you...
Yeah, I mean, there are times, first of all, a lot of these problems can be solved by talking to our children, by explaining things. This is why this is not a good idea for you. This is why we're doing things differently than other people. Now, sometimes it might be the case that the children actually do need to see what it's about, just so that their curiosity is kind of, you know, kind of taken care of. And we need to do that. We don't want them to do that at their friend's house and kind of behind our backs. So then we can show them, right? Okay, and not, of course, not everything is haram, right? So let's say that there are some games where it doesn't involve, like, let's say, talking to strangers. The imagery is, like, decent, right? So we might play with them for a little bit, whatever, you know, once in a while. And so it's not like that we have to kind of ban it completely, but having their own devices is basically where they, it's connected to the internet. That's just a recipe for kind of, you know, inviting them to be exposed to things which are negative to their tarbiyah. The question is that there's a hadith that says we should let children be kings until the age of 7. To what extent do we allow kids to be kings? So, in general, what these type of ahadith, there's not just one, there's a number of ahadith where they encourage basically, you know, treating our children in a way where we're not giving them direct orders. We are still playing the role of parents. We're still encouraging them to go the right way, but we try to avoid giving direct orders. Now, on a practical level, though, it's a guideline. It's not like a wajib haram thing. So it's a guideline. And we have to keep it in mind, but on a practical level, it doesn't work that way that you can always avoid doing so. Right? There are times when it's like, okay, well, no, this is what needs to happen, right? For example, let's say that it's going to involve, you know, destroying somebody's property or hurting somebody, right? Or, you know, there are circumstances that come up where it just, like, you know, for example, like you're going to get late for going to school or whatever it is. There's some times where, you know, you have to kind of do things in a more forceful sort of way. But always try to, you know, realize that children at a younger age, they have that spirit of independence. It needs to be fostered, needs to be encouraged. It's much better to suggest things or to, like, remove those things from their environment which would be harmful for them. So you don't need to tell them that don't do it. It's much better to do that, because if you don't do that, what's going to happen is when they get older, then they might rebel then in the teenage years. Okay? Now, in Islam, boys are supposed to be strong to lead their homes in the future. So, how would we tend to the emotional needs of a son as opposed to a girl, or to what extent? I don't think that we should say that. Okay, boys are supposed to be strong. So, does that mean that girls are supposed to not be strong? I think that, you know, building emotional resilience, building tolerance, right? Building, like, sort of like patience. You know, we have a lot of work to do here in the West. You know, there's a lot of things that we want our children to be able to accomplish. So whether it be a boy or a girl, we want to foster, like, good, you know, those characteristics which are praiseworthy, admirable. That connection to Allah and that deep sort of qualities that can come as a result of that. But yes, it's true that there are some things that we want to make sure that, you know, that we do have, like, some, there is, you know, some sense about masculine sort of senses and masculine traits and feminine traits. And I'm going to, inshallah, be talking about that in one of the nights in the lectures, because it's a very important topic. But just briefly, keeping that in mind, if there's a boy who sort of is treated like any type of, you know, anytime he gets hit or anything happens, he goes cries to his mom, and that's not the right way of raising a boy, right? I mean, a boy should be, you know, kind of told that, okay, you know, you have to kind of man it out, right? And for him to have masculine figures who play an important role in his life is very important. And one of the problems that we have is, you know, crises that we have is men who don't know how to be men, and then they don't know how to perform their responsibilities. They don't take up their responsibilities when it comes to taking care of other people, and that becomes a crisis. Now, again, that doesn't mean that a girl shouldn't have that resilience or she shouldn't have that patience, but there is something to say that her personality is more latif, it's more delicate, and it's more like she needs more, you know, sort of a little bit more delicate approach and tender approach when dealing with the problems that come her way. Okay. Next question, if anybody else. Yes, sister. Alaykum as-salam.
What do you advise, pardon me, what is your advice for parents who are together but have completely different strategies with their children? So one will be completely comfortable with them playing these video games, for example, and the other would not want that. Or alternatively, if there are two parents but are not together and the same things happen, you know, in one household, when they're with one parent, the parent is very disciplined, you know, there is a set structure, you have bedtime, you don't eat junk food, they go to the other parent and the other parent does things differently. What is your advice there?
So, obviously, the preferred approach is to, you know, come to an agreement about a parenting strategy. Like, one of the important recommendations about how to parent is that there should be a united front at all in all circumstances between the father and the mother. Even when there's disagreement, that should be taken up in private, not in front of the children. Now, sometimes it's a matter of kind of, you know, discussing it, working it out, you know, maybe if the other spouse is sort of interested in like doing the best, then trying to like talk to them with logic, with proof, you know, let's go to the scholar, let's listen to this thing, let's try to figure out what are the best parenting techniques. Many of these things that I've talked about, even though they take on a different color when you approach it from a Tawhidi perspective, you find that non-Muslim sources are talking about the same things because they're seeing similar problems occur. If that's not possible, then obviously, we need to do our part, and what we can try to do is be explaining to our children what is it that's going on, why is it that we're saying these things, so that they understand and they can, inshallah, develop the ability to stay away from those things themselves. Right? It's very difficult, right? But in some cases, it can be done if you do good. If they know that you're telling them this, like it's very hard, right, for a child when they're given a candy at a young age to like not eat that candy when they're given it, especially by a parent, right? But if you can somehow get them to like know that you love them so much, and if you're telling them that it's bad for them, it's really, they'll get it. They'll be out of love for you. They'll listen to you. Then that would be the best, so that they themselves will stay away from doing that. But other than that, then I mean, what else can we do, right? If it's a case that, I mean, you know, that sort of thing, I mean, then it's just a matter of maybe seeing if we can sort of work it out so that, you know, maybe like, let's say that's a separate arrangement, then those times where, you know, you really need to be there, you're there for them. And, you know, I don't know. I don't know what else we could do in that case.
Thank you.
What if my son happens to have a classmate who has two fathers, and now I have to explain this to him in a way that doesn't get him, you know, in trouble? How can I explain such? How can I explain this to him?
How old is he?
Well, he's not in school yet, but I think my friend's son is probably in. Probably around six or seven.
So it's your friend's son who has two fathers?
No, no. My friend's son goes to school and his classmate has two fathers.
Ah, I see. So you're asking about how should your friend deal with it?
Yes.
Okay. So brothers and sisters, you know, as you know, Islam has a perspective on what is a family. It has a definition for what makes up a family. Okay. Was that a sign that I'm not supposed to talk about this topic or something? Okay. So anyway, Islam has a perspective on what is a family. And there are other people who have different perspectives, okay? And it's very important that we teach our children that this is what Islam has to say. We have to make this be very deep-rooted in their minds that the family is the Ahlul Bayt. That is the family, you know, like the household, the pure household, and we need to always emulate that. That's our role model. Now, just like everything else, right, we have to teach our children that there are people who have different understandings of things, right? We don't agree with them. It's not right. But at the same time, the reason why they do those things is because they don't have access to, they weren't taught the right things. They weren't given the access to the truth, you know, to the truth, right? So at the same time, we also have to be doing what we can to protect our children from negative influences. And, you know, if we can, for example, avoid, you know, having them, let's say, now in that case, let's say they're in the same class, it might be something which is difficult, but maybe if, let's say that's something which is widespread in that area, but there's another area, another school, maybe a private school, or a, you know, where it's not so much of an issue, then maybe it would be worth, you know, or there's a good Muslim school that actually does the right thing where you could avoid that type of thing, then it would be worth doing so. Because this is just a small example of like where it it could be disturbing for a child, right? And those are the things which are apparent. There's so many subtle things that take place that we don't even realize in the course of being in that type of environment where, again, it really raises question for a child and his or her identity.
Assalamualaikum. I just want to ask you how we can make the deen interesting, because there is a lot of things which is interesting more. How we can put the love of deen in the kid's heart, because for example, my kid, she's taking classes of the Quran classes through the Skype, and again and again every day is a battle to tell her that concentrate, do nicely. I just explain her the benefits of the reciting the Quran and what you get reward from Allah and reward from me as well, but is a struggle, is continuously struggle. So I just want to ask you how we can put the love of the deen.
So it's a very good question, and just like all the other questions, and thank you so much. And I really appreciate the struggle that you that you know parents go through, and may Allah reward you for your sacrifices and your efforts. The question was that how can we put the love of the deen in the hearts of our children? We don't have to put the love of the deen in our hearts and our children. Our children are born with the love of the deen. All children, all human beings are born with fitratullah allati fatara an-nasa alayha, meaning that every human being is born with a natural tendency to love God and to know Him and to want to worship Him. If it's the case that our children are finding learning about the religion boring or not interesting, we're not actually teaching them about the religion then. There's a mismatch there. There is nothing more wonderful for a child than to learn about the religion. So when they're being bored, when they're finding it being a chore, it's one of two things. Either we have a problem in the way it's being taught to them, or there's something which is clouding their fitrah. There's something which is distracting them from connecting to their real identity. So we need to look at both of these things. For example, if there's a child who is hooked on video games and they're in that world, for them to like sort of, you know, be brought out of it, and then you're going to, you know, orient them to like the higher worlds, right? They're just there right now. So you need to cut them off of those type of things so that they go back to being a real human being again. And then when it comes to teaching, you know, if it's like, you know, if it's something which is forced and something which is a chore and it's something which is a lot of like rote and memorization, right? That's not the right approach to take. Our experience has been that children, when you talk to them about, it's not about memorization, it's not about like facts and figures, it's more about like stories and love and like seeing Allah. Now, there's a series of books that you may be aware of. It's published, or there's a number of series of books by Kissa Kids. I want to recommend that to you all. There's also a curriculum as well for teaching Islam from young ages all the way to older ages. I would endorse that. I've been involved with some editing of it as well too. But you can see the approach that they take there is more about like, you know, love and, you know, kind of stories and sort of making it be something which is appealing for the children. So my advice in that case would be that like, okay, like if it's a case that, you know, that teacher, maybe the way that they're doing it, it's not the right approach, right? There's a way to like teach in a way that becomes attractive for children. Let's say that the way that teacher is teaching on Skype is a lot different than what the teaching techniques that they're using in school. Well, it's going to be hard for that child, right? So then we need to like kind of think about it and say that, okay, well, what is it that we can do to make this be something that's actually interesting? And what do we need to do, right? Like maybe if the child doesn't appreciate that this is the word of Allah, then they won't appreciate learning how to read it, right? But if they love Allah and they know that this is from Allah, then they will love His word. So maybe we need to go back and see, well, how much love do they have of Allah or not?
Salam, sorry. I have a few questions. The first is discipline of children. So Islamically, what what is considered discipline? Are we allowed to smack our children? How far should we go in terms of that? I've heard lots of different people say lots of different things. So Sharan, how far, what is the recommended discipline strategy, and what is the limit?
So I think we have some laws around that in this country, right? Yeah? In Canada, we do. I think that maybe somebody could have a theoretical discussion about that, but on a practical level, you know, there are things, right? And generally speaking, like that, using physical force is frowned down upon, and it's discouraged. And in one of the traditions, I don't have the exact tradition in mind right now, but it's likened. The analogy is given to the way animals deal with things, right? So, you know, there's other human approaches to discipline. Yes, like there are some mentions of like sort of ta'adib, but those ones are, it seems that they're more about like sometimes, you know, like a child needs like a sort of like a kind of like a, you press like a sort of a button on them to like kind of wake them up, you know? And it's sort of more of like that type of thing, but not something where it's meant to actually, you know, in any way like hurt them as such, like that type of thing. So, you know, there are other approaches, for example, like of deprivation or about like rewarding, you know, for certain things. There's, you know, the approaches that are taken typically about timeout, right? Those type of things are fine. And it's good to also, in this case, you know, you can consult, you know, in the non-Muslim literature, see the type of things they talk about. There's things like countdown approach and other, and I'm not an expert in this in terms of like, okay, these are all the things and this is the best approach. But what is important is that whatever we do, sometimes in let's say it's repeated type of thing, it might be the case that in that case we would even temporarily like, you know, not talk to them or kind of not talk to them the way we would normally if it's a repeated type of thing, because that love, that if we have that loving relationship, then that would really make even impact on them. But again, it should be maintaining those principles that we talked about. It shouldn't be something where they feel that they're not loved anymore or that they feel they're not respected anymore. So keeping those in mind, the other techniques, and sometimes for one child, it something works. In my experience, like it's been the case that sometimes one thing works for one child, if another child, a different thing works, because you know, children do have their different temperaments.
You've answered the rest of my questions, so thank you.
Assalamualaikum, Sheikh.
Alaikum.
I was wondering, do you have any specific advice for like the first couple of years of a child's life? What kind of specific things to do which may inculcate like the love of God for them later on?
So in the first 2 years, you know, one of the areas that we definitely could be considering is that even before a couple, you know, decides to, let's say, you know, that they want to be blessed with a child from Allah, or even actually before they get married, right, is this idea that the best teacher for my child is going to be me, right? I'm the one who's with them. They're going to be seeing me, right? So the idea of, orienting ourselves on a path to Allah and understanding what that means and how we achieve progress on a path to Allah, which is the same thing as becoming an abd of Allah. It's very, very important. Usually in the first 2 years, what happens is that because it's a new experience, sometimes it's very difficult. There's a lot of like routine issues and like, you know, you can't really maintain a schedule. Usually what happens is that some of those things maybe that parents, especially the mother, was able to regularly do before. For example, before she was regularly reciting Quran, she was on time for her prayers, she would read and acquire Islamic knowledge, she would participate in gatherings. Sometimes all that stuff goes out the window, right? But what ought to happen, you know, and sometimes there's special cases where, you know, it's not possible, but what ought to happen is that now the mother sort of still has that commitment to her self-development, but she needs to now be able to go about it with this additional challenge of having to perform responsibilities to her child as well. like it may be the case that, for example, before she always used to be able to recite Quran like in the evening before she went to bed, but now maybe you know she would have to, when she's feeding the child, for example, she would be reciting Quran, but she still recites Quran. The point is that there's a lot that can be gotten by being involved with spiritual development, by you know, like when there's a lot that's transferred to the child through, let's say, you know, the milk that's being fed to the child. More than just like the physical, there's a lot that's like the child is very much aware of the mother's emotional state. So the child's able to pick up on these things. When the child sees the mother, how she responds to different situations, you know, like the way that she's able to control her temper when she talks to her child about things. Those are things which are very useful, like talking to the child about Allah. Reminding about doing dhikr of Allah, like when she's feeding, these are things which can be very effective. When it comes to having Quran, you know, playing Quran in the home as well, to a certain extent, that's also useful, like filling the atmosphere with like the sound of the word of Allah. But it shouldn't be something which is overly excessive, where we're, you know, all the time, and it becomes something which is sort of the child kind of feels, it, you know, it's like there's a certain point where it becomes extreme. And also, you know, making sure that the child is not exposed to things which are negative to their development. Even non-Muslims will say that for a child to be looking at like moving pictures on a tablet or a screen is very dangerous for the development of their brain. And there have been some studies which show a link between exposure to devices and ADHD. You guys call it ADHD here? Yeah. So these are things which obviously need to be avoided.
I have a question here that's written on a piece of paper. Is sending children to the East, for example, to Hausa, to protect them from Western immorality a good mentality?
So I'm not aware of a program where you can just send the children to the East. I've heard people talk about this idea. I believe that a child should be with their parents, and unless there's some really special circumstance, but the parents are the best ones to take care of the children. So the parents are here. It doesn't really make sense. Let me send my children off to the East. The Hausa is in need of individuals who... It's not a rescue boat for people who are kind of going to drown, and let's kind of put them in the Hausa. The Hausa needs like the people who have already... They're past that point, right? They're like, you know... very, very like set on, you know, what they want to do, and they know what their purpose is. So I don't think that's... Now, if you're asking that, okay, let's say that the challenges are so much here for me. I don't have a way of protecting my children from haram. I see them being corrupted in their ideology. I see them being influenced negatively by the friends, and I don't have any other way. And I do have an option to move to some other place where I'm able to safeguard my children, then... Of course. Now, if that, I mean, I'm just talking about theoretically, of course that would make sense, right? I mean, there are times when hijrah becomes something which is necessary, right? Or sometimes it's something which is, you know, recommended, or something which where it's necessary to do that in order to protect our children. But sending them off and having somebody else do that, that doesn't sound like the right idea.
One other question here. Is there a certain age for a child to stop sleeping with their parents in the same bed, I assume? What should be the age?
I don't have a specific age for you, I know there's a lot of different theories about this. Like is the co-sleeping something which is good or which is not good? I don't know what. I haven't talked to or I haven't seen anything from, like, let's say the experts in Islamic tarbiyah where they've given an opinion on that. So I'm not able to give you a definitive answer on that. But definitely, like, you know, when a child is at that age where they become mumayyiz in this respect, where they start understanding some of these things, then, like, they understand sort of some of, you know, the things around this, and that would definitely not be appropriate at that time for them to be sleeping in the same bed.
We have time for one last question. How do we discipline a child under three without being too harsh? Are timeouts beneficial for their development?
What was the first part of the question? Under three?
How do we discipline a child under three? without being too harsh.
Oh, under three without being too harsh.
Yeah.
Yeah, children under three, discipline doesn't really have a sort of, like, what does that mean? You know, like, I mean, discipline sort of is there when a child is starting to understand, right? They're making decisions. They have that ability to, like, rationalize and make decisions that way. A lot of times, most of the times, when it's a child under three, it's going to be the case that the problem is there's an underlying problem to their behavior. Either they haven't gotten enough sleep, or they're not eating properly, or they haven't eaten properly, or they're sick, or something like that. So we have to do, like, the detective work to figure out why are they behaving in this way. Sometimes it's they have a food allergy that's causing this, or food sensitivity that's causing this type of problem, right? We need to find that. It shouldn't be the case that there's a need to, like, you know, discipline. Now, maybe there's a child who's extremely, you know, advanced for their age or something like that, and the parents realize that, no, they are capable, and so somehow maybe they want to, like, deprive them of access to a toy, or they want to reward them for the positive behavior. That's something that you have to see. Like, you know, children develop also, you know, not all at the same pace, and where you think it would actually make sense, then, okay, you can use it, but it shouldn't be something, again, which goes against those things of love and respect that we talked about. I think, with that, we'll just make a dua. We'll say that, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم ربنا هب لنا من أزواجنا وذرياتنا قرة أعين واجعلنا للمتقين إماما رب اجعلني مقيم الصلاة ومن ذريتي ربنا وتقبل دعاء اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد